Well, hello. Welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and once again, I'll be reading to you this week from my 2005 novel from Tor Books. Someone comes to town, someone leaves town. Let's see, what news for this week? Well, the big one for me was that I upgraded my operating system. I guess most of you are probably in a position somewhat like mine in that you live inside your computer, so an operating system upgrade is a big deal. This one is the latest Ubuntu, which is a flavor of Linux I prefer. It was called Jaunty Jackalope, this latest version, and it has a lot of improvements in it, a lot of small UI improvements, a lot of grace notes, and the upgrade went incredibly smoothly. It's probably the most smooth upgrade I've ever done. I did have one small problem in that it upgraded my Podcatcher program that I was using called Amarok. And so now I'm messing around with trying to get a different Podcatcher working because the upgrade actually broke Amarok for me. One cool thing about Ubuntu that those of you who are Windows and Mac users may not be familiar with is that when you upgrade your operating system with Ubuntu, it actually updates all of your applications at the same time. So it all happens in one go. I've only got a short time today to record this because in about 40 minutes I've got a gentleman from the European Union coming by my office to record a little video for a conference on media literacy in Rome. This is going to be a fun thing, and it's a nice alternative to actually flying to Rome and leaving the family and giving a speech and flying back again, which is quite grueling and always seems a little weird. So this gent from the EU is going to record my contribution and bring it back. And obviously I won't be able to do a Q&A, but at least I'll be able to stay at my desk and get some work done that day. It's not a bad fit, not a bad compromise. I am, however, going abroad soon. End of next week, I'm headed off to Minneapolis for a reading festival, young adult reading festival, and I'm going to be speaking at a school and probably doing a bookstore signing. I'll get some details on that as soon as I have them. And then I'm off to Toronto to see my family, and at the end of the week, I'm going to be at the Ontario Library Association's White Pines event. This is an award that the OLA gives out to young adult literature, for young adult literature, and they have a huge reading festival at Harbourfront, the big public space down on the lake shore, and there'll be thousands of high school kids, and I'm going to talk to them about Little Brother and do a little reading for them. Good Little Brother news this week. I saw my foreign rights agent at the London Book Fair, Danny Barrow, who's kind of a legend and a machine when it comes to foreign rights sales. He sold the German rights to Little Brother to one of the large German publishers for a really substantial sum of money, more than I've ever gotten for any other foreign rights deal. Now, the interesting thing about this is they did this even though there's a free fan translation of Little Brother on the net and has been for some months. And we talked about this, and Danny said, you know, at first they did view that as kind of a threat. They thought, well, maybe the people who wanted to read it in German already have. But then when they thought about it, they said, well, you know, the fact that there's a fan translation that a lot of people have linked to and downloaded suggests that there's actually a market here for this book in German, and that market signal is one that we don't want to ignore. So it was really cool news. It was a really strong validation because the one thing that my agent, who's very good, my book agent Russ Galen, who's very, very good about this stuff, the one thing that he's worried about historically with Creative Commons licenses is whether or not they would impinge on foreign rights deals because, you know, without having that kind of close personal relationship that I have with my publisher in New York, these foreign publishers may not understand the Creative Commons stuff, they may just be kind of gun shy about it or nervous about it. It's really good to see it proven out here in the German context. The last thing I want to mention here is a little plug for a forthcoming book. My friend Richard Kadrey's publisher, Ace Books, sent me a copy of his latest book, a book called Sandman Slim. Richard, I've loved his work since his first book, Metrophage, which came out when I was in school. He shot the portrait for my first dust jacket for Down and Out the Magic Kingdom. He's quite a great freelance photographer as well as a writer. And Sandman Slim, I think, is his best book. Really kind of badass, hard-boiled, supernatural demon novel set in Los Angeles, and that'll be out this July. It's called Sandman Slim by Richard Kadrey, and I'll have a review up on Boing Boing the day it comes out, but I just wanted to let you know because my head has been full of this book since I finished it on Saturday. I just haven't been able to get it out of my head, so something to mark your calendars for. All right, then, that's enough formatter. On to the book. Kurt had an assembly line cranking out his access points now. Half a dozen street kids worked in the front of his place, in a cleared-out space with a makeshift workbench made from bowed plywood and scratched IKEA table legs. It made Alan feel better to watch them making sense of it all, made him feel a little like he felt when he was working on the inventory. The kids worked from noon, when Kurt got back from breakfast, until 9 or 10, when he went out to dive. The kids were smart, but screwed up, half by teenage hormones and half by bad parents or bad drugs or just bad brain chemistry. Alan understood their type, trying to carve some atom of individual identity away from their family and background, putting pins through their bodies and affecting unconvincing, tough mannerisms. They were often bright. The used bookstore had been full of their types, buying good, beat-up books off the sale rack for 50 cents, trading them back for 20 cents credit the next day, buying more. Natalie and Link were in that morning, along with some newcomers, Montreal street punks, who were trying their hands at something other than squeegee bumming. The punks and his neighbors gave each other easy looks, but Alan had deliberately put the sugar for the coffee at the punks' end of the table, and the cream in front of Natalie, and the stirs by the bathroom door with the baklava and the napkins, so rudimentary social intercourse had begun. First, one of the punks, who had a rusty No Future pin that Alan thought would probably go for real coin on the collector's market, and asked Natalie to pass her the cream. Then Link and another punk, foppy, silly black hair and a cut-down private school blazer with short sleeves pinned on with rows of safety pins, met over the baklava, and the punk offered Link a napkin. Another punk spilled coffee on her lap, screeching horrendous Quebecois blasphemies as curses, and that cracked everyone up, and Arnold, watching from near the blanket that fenced off Kurt's monkish sleeping area, figured that they would get along. "Kurt," he said, pulling aside the blanket, handing a double-double coffee over to Kurt as he sat up and rubbed his eyes. He was wearing a white T-shirt that was the grimy gray of everything in his domain, and baggy jockeys. He gathered his blankets around him and sipped reverently. Kurt cocked his head and listened to the soft discussions going on the other side of the blanket. "Christ, they're at it already? I think your volunteers showed up a couple hours ago. Or maybe they were up all night." Kurt groaned theatrically. "I'm running a halfway house for geeky street kids." "It's all for the cause," Alan said. "So what's on your plate for today?" "You know that church that's kitty-corner from your place?"
"Yeah," Alan said cautiously.
"Its spire is just about the highest point in the market, and omnidirectional up there."
"The church?"
"Yeah. What about the new condos at the top of Baldwin? They're tall." "They are, but they're up on the northern edge. From the bell tower of that church, I bet you could shoot half the houses on the west side of Oxford Street, along with the backs of all the shops on Augusta. How are we going to get them to go along with it? Christ, what are they, Ukrainian Orthodox?"
"Greek Orthodox," Kurt said. "Yeah, they're pretty conservative."
"So?" "So I need a smooth-talking, upstanding sit to go and put the case to the pastor, or priest, or bishop, or whatever."
"Groan," Alex said. "Oh, come on, you're good at it."
"If I get the time," he said, and he looked into his coffee for a moment. "I'm going to go home," he said.
"Home?"
"To the mountain," he said. "Home," he said. "To my father," he said.
"Whoa," Kurt said. "Alone?"
Alan sat on the floor and leaned back against a milk crate full of low-capacity hard drives. "I have to," he said. "I can't stop thinking of..." He was horrified to discover that he was on the verge of tears. It had been 3 weeks since Davy had vanished into the night, and he dreamt of Eugene Fabio Gregg every night since, terrible dreams, in which he dug like a dog to uncover their hands, their arms, their legs, but never their heads. He swallowed hard. He and Kurt hadn't spoken of that night since.
"I sometimes wonder if it really happened," Kurt said.
Alan nodded. "It's hard to believe, even for me."
"I believe it," Kurt said. "I won't ever not believe it. I think that's probably important to you."
Alan felt a sob well up in his chest and swallowed it down again.
"Thanks," he managed to say.
"When are you leaving?" "Tomorrow morning. I'm going to rent a car and drive up."
"How long?"
"I don't know," he said. He was feeling morose now. "A couple days, a week, maybe. No longer."
"Well, don't sweat the bishop. He can wait. Come and get a beer with me tonight before I go out?"
"Yeah," he said. "That sounds good.
on a patio in Kensington, we can people watch. How Alan and his brothers killed Davy. Very deliberately. Alan spent the rest of the winter in the cave, and Davy spent the spring in the golem's cave, and through that spring neither of them went down to the school, so that the younger brothers had to escort themselves to class. When the thaws came and icy melt-off carved temporary streams in the mountainside, they stopped going to school too. Instead, they played on the mountainside, making dams and canals and locks with rocks in their imagination. Their father was livid. The mountain rumbled as it warmed unevenly, as the sheets of ice slid off its slopes and skittered down toward the highway. The sons of the mountain reveled in their dark ignorance, their separation from the school and from the nonsensical and non-magical society of the town. They snared small animals and ate them raw, and didn't wash their clothes, and grew fierce and guttural through the slow spring. Alan kept silent through those months, becoming almost nocturnal, refusing to talk to any brother who dared to talk to him. When Ed Fred George brought home a note from the vice principal asking when he thought he'd be coming back to school, Alan shoved it into his mouth and chewed and chewed and chewed until the paper was reduced to gruel and he spat it into the matted pile of his bedding. The mountain grumbled and he didn't care. The golems came to parley, and he turned his back to them. The stalactites crashed to the cave's floor until it was carpeted in ankle-deep chips of stone, and he waded through them. He waited and bided. He waited for Davy to try to come home. "What have we here?" Alan said as he wandered into Kurt's shop, which had devolved into joyous bedlam. The shelves had been pushed up against the wall, clearing a large open space that was lined with long trestle tables. Crusty punks, goth kids, hippie kids, geeks with vintage video game shirts, even a couple of older, hard-done-by street people crowded around the tables, performing a conglomeration of arcane tasks. The air hummed with conversation and coffee smells, the latter emanating from a catering-sized urn in the corner. He was roundly ignored, and before he could speak again, one of the PCs on the floor started booming out fuzzy, grungy rockabilly music that made him think of Elvis cassettes that had been submerged in salt water. Half of the assembled mass started bobbing their heads and singing along, while the other half rubbed their eyes and groaned. Kurt came out of the back and hunkered down with the PC, turning the volume down a little. "Howdy," he said, spreading his arms and taking in the whole of his dominion. "Howdy yourself," Alan said. "What have we here?" "We have a glut of volunteers," Kurt said, watching as an old rummy carefully shot a picture of a flat-panel LCD that was minus its housing. "I can't figure out if those laptop screens are worth anything," he said, cocking his head, "but they've been taking up space for far too long. Time we moved them." Alan looked around and realized that the workers he'd taken to be at work building access points were, in the main, shooting digital pictures of junk from Kurt's diving runs and researching them for eBay listings. It made him feel good, great even. It was like watching an inventory being assembled from out of the chaos. "Where'd they all come from?" Kurt shrugged. "I don't know. I guess we hit critical mass. You recruit a few people, they recruit a few people. It's a good way to make a couple bucks. You get to play with this boss crap, you get paid in cash, and you have colorful co-workers." He shrugged again. "I guess they came from wherever the trash came from. The city provides." The homeless guy they were standing near squinted up at them. "If either of you say something like, these people were discarded by society, but just as the junk we rescue from landfills, we have seen the worth of these poor folks and rescued them from the scrap heap of society, I'm going to puke." "The thought never crossed my mind," Alan said solemnly. "Keep it up, Wes," Kurt said, patting the man on the shoulder. "See you at the Greeks tonight?" "Every night, so long as he keeps selling the cheapest beer on the market," Wes said, winking at Alan. "It's cash in the door," Kurt said. "Buying components is a lot more efficient than trying to find just the right parts." He gave Alan a mildly reproachful look. Ever since they'd gone to strictly controlled design, Kurt had been heartbroken by the amount of really nice crap that never made its way into the access points. "This is pretty amazing," Alan said. "You're splitting the money with them?" "The profit. Anything left over after buying packaging and paying the postage." He walked down the line, greeting people by name, shaking hands, marveling at the gewgaws and gimcracks that he, after all, had found in some nighttime dumpster and brought back to be recycled. "God, I love this. It's like Napster for dumpsters." "How's that?" Alan asked, pouring himself a coffee and adding some UHT cream from a giant, slightly dented box of creamers. "Most of the music ever recorded isn't for sale at any price, like 80% of it. And the labels, they've made copyright so strong, no one can figure out who all the music belongs to, not even them. Costs a fortune to clear a song. pal of mine once did a CD of Christmas music remixes, and he tried to figure out who owned the rights to all the songs that he wanted to use. He gave up after a year, and he had only cleared one song. So along comes Napster. It finds the only possible way of getting all that music back in our hands. It gives millions and millions of people to rip their old CDs, hell, their old vinyl and tapes too, and put them online. No label could have afforded to do that, but the people just did it for free. It was like a barn raising. It was a library raising. Alan nodded. So what's your point? That companies' dumpsters are being Napstered by people like you? A Napsterized inventory. Alan felt the rightness of it. Kurt picked a fragile LCD out of a box of dozens of them and smashed it on the side of the table. Exactly, he said. This is garbage. It's like the deleted music that you can't buy today, except at the bottom of bins at Goodwill or at yard sales. Tons of it is accumulated in landfills. No one could afford to pay enough people to go around and rescue it all and figure out the copyrights for it and turn it into digital files and upload it to the net. But if you give people an incentive to tackle a little piece of the problem and a way to, for my work to help you... He went to a shelf and picked up a finished AP and popped its latches and swung it open. Look at that. I didn't get its guts out of a dumpster, but someone else did, like as not. I sold the parts I found in my dumpster for money that I exchanged for parts that someone else found in her dumpster. Her? Trying not to be sexist, Kurt said. Are there female dumpster divers? Got me, Kurt said. In 10 years of this, I've only run into other divers twice or three times. Remind me to tell you about the cop later. Anyway, we spread out the effort of rescuing this stuff from the landfill, and then we put our findings online and move it to where it needs to be. So it's not cost-effective for some big corporation to figure out how to use or sell these. So what? It's not cost-effective for some big dumb record label to figure out how to keep the music by any of my favorite bands in print either. We'll figure it out. We're spookily good at it. Spookily? I'm trying to be more poetic. He grinned and twisted the fuzzy split ends of his newly blue mohawk around his fingers. Got a new girlfriend. She says there's not enough poetry in my views on garbage. They found one of Davy's old nests in March, on a day when you could almost believe that the spring would really come and the winter would go and the days would lengthen out to more than a few hours of sour grayness huddled around noon. The reference design for the access points had gone through 4 more iterations, and if you knew where to look in the market's second-story apartments, rooftops, and lampposts, you could trace the evolution of the design from the clunky, PC-shaped box in Alan's attic on Wales Avenue to the environment-hardened mil-spec surplus boxes that Kurt had rigged from old circuit boxes he'd found in Bell Canada's Willowdale switching station dumpster. Alan steadied the ladder while Kurt tightened the wing nuts on the antenna mounting atop the synagogue's roof. It had taken 3 mornings with the old rabbi before Alan hit on the idea of going to the temple's youth caucus and getting them to explain it to the old cleric. The synagogue was one of the oldest buildings in the market, a brick and stone beauty from the 1930s. They'd worried about the fight they'd have over drilling through the roof to punch down a wire, but they needn't have. The wood up there was as soft as cottage cheese and showed gaps wide enough to slip the power cable down. Now Kurt slathered Loctite over the nuts and washers and slipped dangerously down the ladder, toe-tips flying over the rungs. Alan laughed as he touched down, thinking that Kurt's heart was aburst with the feeling of having finished, at last, at last. But then he caught sight of Kurt's face, ashen and wide-eyed. "I saw something," he said, talking out of the sides of his mouth. His hands were shaking. "What?" "Footprints," he said. "There's a lot of leaves there that have rotted down to mud, and there were a pair of little footprints in the mud, like a toddler's footprints, maybe, except that there were 2 toes missing from 1 foot. They were stamped down all around this one spot where I could see that there were a lot of pigeon nests, but there were no pigeons there, only a couple of beaks and legs, so dried up that I couldn't figure out what they were at first. But I recognized the footprints, the missing toes. They left prints behind like unbent paper clips." Alan moved, as in a dream, to the ladder and began to climb it. "Be careful. It's all rotten up there," Kurt called. Alan nodded. "Sure, thank you," he said, hearing himself say it as though from very far away. The rooftop was littered with broken glass and scummy puddles of meltwater and little pebbles and a slurry of decomposing leaves, and there, yes, there were the footprints, just as advertised. He patted the antenna box absently, feeling its solidity, and he sat down cross-legged before the footprints and the beaks and the legs. There were no tooth marks on the birds. They hadn't been eaten. They'd been torn apart, like a label from a beer bottle absently shredded in the sunset. He pictured Davy sitting here on the synagogue's roof, listening to the evening prayers and the calls and music that floated over the market, watching the gray winter night come on and slip away, a pigeon in his hand, writhing. He wondered if he was catching Bradley's precognition, and if that meant that Bradley was dead now.